Hey everybody, I am Fred. I am a very grateful recovering alcoholic and drug user, and I'd like to share my story. Hopefully, maybe you can get something from it, learn something that can maybe help you in your recovery as well. So, I'll just start out. You know, I was born right outside of New York City in Queens. Jamaica section of Queens, which isn't a very desirable place. It wasn't back then. It really isn't now, but we were a pretty big family. I was the middle of five, had an older brother and sister that were only 13 months apart. And then there was 3 years of me and then another 4 years. And then a little sister and a younger brother who were about 15 months apart. So I was like the epitome of a middle child. Don't know if that's a real thing or not, but when we weren't doing anything as a family, I was alone a lot. So I had to occupy my time doing stuff, mostly like puzzles and reading and mostly music, I would say. Music was always and still is a big part of my life. We were Catholic, raised a very strict Catholic. Went to Catholic school. Everything, the jokes that you hear about Catholic school are probably 100% true, except I never saw or anything or heard about like the really bad stuff. But you got beat. That was for certain. And if the nuns ever started a baseball team, they would not be short of starting pitchers because they could peg you in the side of the head with an eraser from 20 feet at any moment of time. But so church was a part of my life, and it was just so regimented. I couldn't get into it. I knew all the prayers by the time I was like 10, and then I could recite them all. And it was the same thing over and over and over, and the repetition was crazy. So I just didn't buy it. I didn't really get into it all, I guess. But anyway, because I went to Catholic school, so I had to go to church every day, and then you had to be an altar boy, so that meant church twice a day during school days and then on Sunday. So there was a lot of it. But first big change in my life was right after my sixth grade year, getting ready to start junior high, my family up and moved to Florida. So I went from like 95% concrete and steel and maybe 5% grass to like 95% grass and 5% concrete and steel and sitting on top of the gates of hell. Just the heat was just incredibly crazy to us. Anyway, you know, starting a new school in the beginning of junior high was tough, not knowing a single person. Eventually made some friends, you know, and throughout 7th, 8th, and then half the 9th grade. And then something happened I really don't remember, but my parents decided to move across town. So right in the middle of 9th grade, because junior high in Florida was 7, 8, 9, high school was 10, 11, 12. So right in the middle of 9th grade, when I'm getting ready to go to high school, to this one high school, we move across town. I go to a brand new high school or junior high. I don't know anybody, and I'm going to a different high school. So that one kind of messed me up a little bit. And then I don't know if that had anything to do with it, but I met a friend that year who introduced me to pot. So that's my first drug introduction, was that new junior high. And I really liked the way it made me feel. I laughed, you know, never felt like I wasn't in control. I'm sure I wasn't totally, obviously, but anyway, so that went on for a few years, and then, you know, I really liked it. And then, you know, we were pretty poor as a family. Really, really close family, by the way, but poor. And not one single person in my family that I know, cousins, uncles, aunts, whatever, none of them, except for one uncle, had any issue with anything as far as drugs or alcohol. So, funny story, in 10th grade, we wanted to get high, so we didn't have money. So how do we go about it? My buddy's sister was married to a guy who was the local dope dealer. So we got him to front us a bag for $25. It was. So we had smoking areas in the schools, and that's where people would sell the joints. So we figured out, hey, we get this bag for $25, roll 25 joints, big ones, not the little pin things they were selling. We'd sell out quickly, and then the rest was our stash. We weren't in it to make money. We were in it to get buzzed. So anyway, doing that, and then, you know, when I'm going through the rolling process and stuff, you get seeds and stems, whatever. So I started growing a plant. This is how ignorant my family was to any type of drug use. I had a plant growing, and my mom's like, hey, what's that? And I'm like, it's a biology experiment. Next thing I know, it's got the prime spot in the window getting all the sun, and she's helping me grow it. So one day I came home from school, and it wasn't there, and I found it in the backyard, and I was like, okay, time's up. Got in some trouble, whatever, but, you know, they just really didn't understand any of it. They didn't know what it was doing. Gradually, you know, you hang around more people, you get introduced to more things. Quaaludes were big when I was in high school. It was a painkiller that was being prescribed by the doctors for people who had back problems. So it was, if you're not familiar with it, what it did, it kind of made you feel drunk without the side effects of being drunk. And so we did that quite a bit. Had a friend's mom call me one day and said, hey, I need you to come over here and help my buddy, help your friend, help my son, Chris. So I'm like, oh God, you know? So I hop on my bike right over there and I walk in and I'm like, oh shit, he is fucked up. So I'm sitting there, I go to talk to him and he just kept saying over and over, Fred, promise me, you'll never do mushrooms, promise me. And I was like, check, if it's this much fun, I'll pass. And I was afraid of heroin. I was afraid of anything that was like that. So that never, ever became an issue. And I had a girlfriend whose parents, we were 16, and they would buy her beer as long as she stayed in the house and drank it. So I didn't drink beer very much. And I tried to keep up with her, and I got sick. And I would throw up, and anytime I would have alcohol or anything, I'd end up throwing up. So I just didn't, just never really got to me. So I passed on it. And, you know, LSD came along, and then, man, that was the best. It was great. So high school's done, you know, get a job outside. Couldn't afford college at all. I mean, like, our family was really poor, and there weren't very many programs back in that time. So it was just out of the question. So I immediately went to work at a high school, had a job, and I got to the highest point I could in about a year and a half. And I just needed more. So buddy of mine said, hey, I'm joining the Navy. I'm like, what in the hell are you doing that for? And he's like, man, then you go to electronic school, man, you can get out and do anything. So I was like, hey, right on. That's awesome. Sounds good. So I did it. And, you know, boot camp, pretty piece of cake, you know, you're in shape when you're in your, when you're 19 and stuff. But they drug test you. So all the drugs that I like doing were going to come up in drug tests. So I had to stop. And stopping wasn't very hard. And once I got through boot camp and stuff, and then I went to school, school was an all day thing. It was 5 to 11 at night. 5 days a week, and nothing but electronics all day long, learning theory, doing practice, whatever. So there was one class of about 80 people divided into three shifts. So the women, they all had to be in the day shift class. They could be on the other night classes for whatever reason. So my class was perfect for me, 5 to 11. So we'd get off and then start drinking, and then I would fight through it and finally got past that point of throwing up all the time. So, you know, they say that alcoholics have a very strong will, or drug addicts as well. And I had a strong enough will where I was going to pass that point of getting sick, and then I was going to start enjoying it. And I did. So drinking really became prominent. And then through the years I was in the Navy, we're going all these different countries and things. And the first thing we would do is just get in a cab or whatever and get to the nearest bar and just get hammered. And it was funny because one of my buddies posted on our ship's page the other day, it's like the armed forces at 6 a.m. and they go Air Force and all the guys are in their bunks sleeping. Marines, and they're all in formation running, and they're Navy, and it's a bunch of sailors. You can tell are all freaking whacked out of their heads, you know. It's like, been there a bunch of times, you know, just getting back to the ship at 6 o'clock. So drinking kind of gradually escalated, and saw a lot of things happening, you know, like with people that were married, and you know, you're gone 6 months, and we didn't have cell phones yet, you know, so communication was mostly letters. You know, we'd get on these, it was a ham radio they could do every once in a while, you know, and you always had to say, hey, mom, over, where are you? Over, oh, can't tell you that, you know. And anyway, communication was pretty much none. And all these guys I knew, they're, you know, seemed like they had a good marriage, and they were all getting divorced because their wives wouldn't wait on them, or they were out running around on their wives. So it's like, oh, man, I'm not getting married while I'm still in. And then one day I'm at a party, and there she was. Bam! I was like, oh, my God, there it was. You know, the freaking little music playing in the background and all that stuff. And I was very, I guess from being, you know, a middle child or whatever, I was always comfortable being alone. And I was like the epitome of the word introvert. I would talk to you, but you would probably have to start the conversation. So those of you who know me from AR, you'd be like, hey, what? Oh, boy, I gotta tell you to shut up now. But before, I was super, super quiet, and I would talk. So I had the nuts to go up and talk to her, and we started dating, and eventually we got serious, and she got pregnant, so we got married, and had my daughter. Things were going pretty good. Everything was going great. And then we started being really careful because I had to get out of the Navy. There was no way I was going back to sea and leaving my family. You know, I love my daughter. I love my wife. I wasn't leaving them for 6 months at a time anymore. Plus, I wanted to make some money because in the Navy, you're pretty much on poverty level pay back then. And so it was getting close time for me to get out. And we were not careful one time, and bam, I'm pregnant. Well, that's a pre-existing condition. So if I would have got out as planned and got a job anywhere, regardless, she had a pre-existing condition, so we wouldn't have had any kind of prenatal care. So I stayed in until my son was born. My drinking really was started to escalate really bad around that same time. And my brother was on his way to be a rock and roll star. So he was driving from Orlando, and he stopped at Jacksonville, where I was stationed overnight. We go to a keg party, come back playing video games. I get up to go to the bathroom or go to bed. And there's my wife coming down the hallway. She's like, oh, my plug just fell out. I'm like, oh shit. So I am freaking tanked. So I get in the car, and my priority is getting there, and the biggest priority of getting there was blasting Rush as loud as I could, because my son was going to be born listening to Rush. I don't know if it worked or not. It's his favorite band, his, you know, whatever, but she was so fucking mad at me. It was incredible. And plus, I'm in there in the freaking delivery room doing the push thing, and I'm sure them guys are like, Jesus Christ, this guy, man. Ooh. So I eventually got out, and went to a job fair and gave my resume to a whole bunch of places, and saw this one, you know, this big sign, satellite communications, has a picture of the Earth, picture of the moon. I'm like, oh, man, I can't do any of that crap, but gave my resume anyway. And then they called me the very next day, and because of the type of training I had in radar and radio frequency, it's exactly what you need to be in the payload portion of building a communication satellite. So off we go. We moved to New Jersey, and something happened to her when she had my son. He was 10 pounds. He was normal birth, and it was just he was gigantic coming out. And I saw the whole thing. I'm like, whoa, shit, but I'm not a girl. But, she just said to me one day, I just I don't feel like doing it. I don't want to do it anymore. And I'm like, ever? She's like, I just don't want to. So that began 12 years of, I call it living like a monk. I don't know what it was called. I loved my kids to death and I wasn't going to leave. And it was confusing. It devastated me because, man, who doesn't like having sex, you know? And it was just cut off just like that. Wow, done. And I didn't know that it was called resentment at the time, but I really started not to like her anymore. And it just kept building and building. And then beer wasn't enough. I was getting full. And so it was Jack Daniels. Here I go. And a friend of mine played a song the other day, and it's kind of funny. The words were the guy, you know, he's in heaven because he's was drinking Tennessee whiskey and Old Number 7 or something. I don't remember the exact words, but I was like, damn, that song's about me. You know, that could be me. I put probably a couple kids through college, all the Jack Daniels I bought and drank. But anyway, as we went through this fucking daily routine, I just my love of my kids just kept me there, you know. But and I wouldn't even think about divorce because, you know, what guy gets the kids, you know. So, 6 years I'm working, building communication satellites, fucking amazing job. You get to go, once you're done with the satellite, you get to go put it on top of a rocket, then you're part of the launch, and then whoever bought it, you got to go where they're going to operate it from, and then make sure that it went through the testing. But being an alcoholic like I was really turning into at the time, every milestone during the project, they always had a party with open bars. Man, I would get so fucked up. And I thought everybody else was too, you know, but, well, apparently not. Well, we went through a merger, and there was only one place I could go would be California if I wanted to stay working there. And just the whole logistics, the money, it just wasn't going to work. So the last satellite that I built, I had to go to Cheyenne, Wyoming and test it. And I'm all East Coast my whole life. And like, man, Cheyenne, Wyoming, god dang, they're probably riding horses and shit in the street. They're not. They do sometimes, but, you know, they're civilized. So I'm there, and then the guy I'm working with, you know, we're working 12-hour shifts, and he's an employee of Dish Network, and I'm the employee of Lockheed. And I know he's, and of course, I could tell a New York accent in a second. So I'm like, what are you doing here? And he's like, oh, man, this is a fucking great place to raise kids. I don't know if you're the law that's out there that has a – that causes – that makes the sexual – offender have to register in the neighborhood was originally called Megan's Law, of a little girl named Megan Kanka. And where I was living in New Jersey, where she lived was literally like 5 minutes from my house, and she was the exact same age as my daughter, and her next door neighbor raped and killed her. So that law came from that incident, and it was called Megan's Law for a long time. I don't know what it's, if it even has a name now. It's just a thing that happens. So we were talking about, you know, we want to get out of here, you know, because watching Philadelphia news, it was a freaking, it was excitement, you know, somebody's dying, somebody's getting carjacked, it was crazy. So I'm driving around after talking to my buddy that I just met, and he's, you know, just told me it was a great place to raise kids, and on the radio, somebody said that somebody got arrested because they illegally dumped their car oil. I'm like, holy shit, that makes some news on the radio? So I'm back and I told her, and she was like, okay, well, moving to Cheyenne was an alcoholic's dream come true. 7 days a week, Monday through Saturday, 7 a.m. through 2 a.m. they sell. Sunday was like, I want to say 8 or 9 to 10. And then the bars were open till 2, 7 days a week. And then you go down the main street and there's just bar after bar, liquor store, pawn shops, and it's crazy. Literally, that's the way the main drag, the drag was downtown. You know, hotels here and there, shops, but predominantly bars and liquor stores. The liquor store in there was called DT's, of all things, and they had a pink elephant as their little mascot. It's crazy. But I was never without alcohol, so this whole resentment toward not being able to sleep with my own wife. You know, I still desired her. She looked good. Everything was great. But, man, that frustration was killing me. And I was getting really depressed. So what does an alcoholic do when he's depressed? You know, you take a depressant, you know, drink more alcohol. And I'd get myself to the point where plenty of times in my drinking, I had gotten to oblivion a lot of times, but mostly it was around, you know, with other people or at parties or whatever. Then I found myself getting to oblivion way more often than it was by myself. And it was just to numb all that shit that she was putting me through. Well, she wasn't, I don't know if it was putting me through something, but I was just fucking, just crazy frustrated. I couldn't stand it. And I believed in the vows, and I've always been a pretty loyal person. And I, you know, I could have probably cheated like crazy. I'm positive that at that point she wasn't cheating on me, because she just, I don't know. I'm pretty positive. Near the end, she did. but anyway, I wouldn't leave. So I started getting drunk and drunk and drunk really bad all the time, to the point where I couldn't function, or I couldn't imagine not going to get some liquor at some point, going to get some Jack Daniels, to be specific. And she comes to me one day and says, hey, I want a divorce. And I'm like, fuck. Because I really liked working for Dish Network. It was great. We built this ground station up from nothing. It was the biggest, second biggest one in the world for satellite communications for TV. And I was running the radio frequency part of it. And so I, you know, I was kind of up there, and I made really good money and all this. And well, she took, you know, she got to take half everything, even like the things that I got on the side for bonuses and stuff like that. She took all of it. And it was a lot of money that she got as a lump sum. And the thing I was afraid of the most is she's going back to Florida, and I got to quit my job now and move back to Florida, because I'm not going to be without my kids. So I'm fucking stressing big time. Come to find out, she didn't even want the kids. So I'm like, God damn, I wish I'd have fucking known that years ago, because I'd ended this and had my kids a long time ago and been done with this frustration. Anyway, so she takes off, and then I'm still able to function well at work, well enough to where they decided that the FCC rules the airwaves, and they passed a law that if you're going to broadcast any kind of television, you have to do every single local channel for that city. And in the beginning, you could be living in like San Antonio, but your local channels would be Houston. And what does that benefit you when it comes to commercials? None. Anyway, so they passed a law for that specific reason to do that. And in order to do that, we had to build more ground stations and launch more complicated satellites. So one of the places was to build would be the San Antonio area, and it ended up being in New Braunfels. And they asked me if I wanted to run it. I'm like, hell yeah, get me the fuck out of Cheyenne. So I packed up my kids and came to New Braunfels. And at first it was good, but I was still drinking a lot. And I met, you know, some friends that drank a lot too. So I kept up drinking a lot. But I was still there and made sure that I was doing the right things for my kids. My daughter, she just lost her mind, and she, you know, moving. I did to her what my parents kind of did to me, you know, ripped her out of school with all her friends. And she was already in high school by this time. And, you know, cause when I got custody of them, she was only 11 and my son was 9. And, anyway, I ripped her out of high school with all her friends, and she's down here and just couldn't make friends in school. And at that point, the guy that my kid's mom slept with while we were still together right before the end, she married and was back in Cheyenne. So my daughter had an out. So she made our lives so miserable that I finally said, okay, go. You can go live with your mom. So she took off. She went back to Cheyenne. She's still there today. And supposed to be there today, actually, but that didn't work out. So I'm at my son's house. Anyway, So it was my son and I had a big ass house. Well, he goes through high school doing all his things. I go through some really terrible, terrible relationships. I mean, I had 12 years of fucking pent up energy and I was not a good person to women. I would say whatever I needed to say to get what I wanted and then that was it. And I really didn't like that person at all because it wasn't how I was brought up. But I didn't care. Especially when I'm drunk, I didn't give a shit about anything. My amends was huge, huge, way bigger than I wanted it to be for sure. But anyway, when my son left for college, I was by myself. I had nobody to check me. And the empty nest syndrome is a true thing. My son and I, we were so close, and then we're still close today. He was one of the ones who stuck with me, but I just got, man, it turned bad. And then all of a sudden, after a couple of years, I had 22 years with, Dish Network. I was well respected in the satellite communications industry. People may not have known me, but they knew my name and what I did. And my boss come from Arizona. And the head of security fly over to New Braunfels, come into my office and say, "Come on, you're out of here." Because at that point, I had got to the point where it was, I was having a drink to function. I'd wake up shaking, throwing up, dry heaving, sweating like crazy. And the only thing that I could do was I could get liquor. If I could get liquor in me, you know, maybe the first couple of drinks, I'd get rid of that real quick. But then it was still enough in there to start to calm the anxiety. And, then another couple drinks and I stopped shaking. I stopped, dry heaving and then I could go to work. And then I bought into the whole, I wasn't a whiskey drinker. I mean, I was a whiskey drinker. I didn't drink vodka, but I bought into that bullshit about, man, people can't smell vodka on you. So I started drinking that during the day and, it caught up to me, and they walked me out in front of my whole team. You know, here to get a guy that's running the fucking place, walking him out. So I had a good 401k, so I lived on that for a little while. I even moved back to Cheyenne to try to get straight because I had tanked hard after getting walked out of there. First thing I did was just go to a liquor store and get a fucking half gallon and start drinking that. So I moved back to Cheyenne trying to get my shit together. But I think part of me was knowing that it's frustrating on Sundays to get liquor. And then we went to meetings for a couple hours. You know, it was, like I said, like a bad vacation with people that you didn't know. But I stayed sober 6 months when I got back from there. And that was the longest ever since I was 15 years old that something didn't affect my brain. And I was like, man, this is awesome. And then my sponsor said the worst thing in the world to me. He's like, man, you got this. I'm like, yeah, you're right. I got this. And I quit going to meetings. I quit doing anything. I quit calling them. And then, of course, well, I got this. I can have a couple drinks. Boom. Nope. They call it craving. And it's the way I think of the word craving is like it's something that you don't have that you want. You know, like I'm craving a piece of chocolate. I'm craving a chocolate milkshake. I'm craving whatever. And then you try to go get it. Well, what they call craving for an alcoholic, and I guess it's the same for drugs, it's after you have the first couple that your brain clicks into this thing that they call craving and it needs and has to have more. There's just never, ever enough. So each time that I would relapse, I would get to the crescendo point of oblivion quicker than the time before to where I was having a drink in order to function. Otherwise, I was on the floor shaking and dry heaving. So this goes, I went to a few detox, went to that one rehab. Longest I was able to maintain was 2 months. And then you know, I went through, in February 20th of 2019, I went to a detox because I was hurt bad. And my son and his wife came and got me and, took me there and then moved all my shit into storage. And that was the day I knew exactly what it was going to be like when I died. everybody in the place was freaking out. I could see their faces. They were all concerned, you know, looking at me. I had anxiety that was so fucking through the roof. I couldn't imagine it. And it's going crazy. My blood pressure was like 220 something over 160 something. Just bad, bad. And they're just like, man, we need you to calm down. I'm like, I can't, you know. Finally, I got to sit down and actually stay sitting down for a while, and it finally kicked in. And I knew without one shred of a doubt that that's exactly how it was going to feel before that final heart attack would get me. And it wasn't fun by any stretch of the imagination. And I always promised myself when I got tattoos, I'd never, you know, because of my job mostly that I used to have, really can't have them visible because of the meetings and stuff I'd have to attend with all high level executives and stuff like that. So I could wear a short suit shirt and never have one. But this one I got right on the inside of my wrist because I never wanted to ever forget how I felt. It wasn't that it was a sober date, which it was, but it's not my sober date, which is sad, but I knew that's, I never want to forget what it felt like to know I was dying. Even though I was praying for it, I wanted to be dead. There was no doubt I wanted death. I had nothing to live for. I couldn't keep any relationship. I chased away probably 3 really good women that I had relationships, but I could never put anything before drinking, ever. Starting, I don't know when, but I just couldn't do it. Drinking was first. That was the top priority. My day was planned around that. By the time the stores open, if it was bad, it was a Sunday or something. If it was a weekday, you know, oh, I got to get to 7 o'clock, I can get a Four Loko. Bad as they tasted, 2 of them would get me until 10 o'clock to where I could get my liquor. And that's how I planned my dates, and it was crazy. So after that detox, I made it another 2 months or so. Actually, 2 months, and then I fell again really, really hard. And I tried one more time and got out of detox. You know, it only takes 5 days, and you feel fine when you leave there. You're fuzzy, but you're still pretty fine as far as things. So I got a really decent job. And my son had somehow activated the tracker, or whatever it is on the iPhones that, you know, you can see where the phone is at any time. And got this job doing really good. And then that fucking head took over where I could have a couple drinks. And I just remember so many days just laying on the floor, just, okay, please just take me. Let this end. I wanted to die so bad, but I couldn't commit suicide. I know people who've had family members do it, and I know what it does to the people that's left. So my opinion only is that I think it's a chicken shit way out, because my shit's over the moment it happens, and then everybody else's just starts that cares about me. And all the people that I didn't drive away, I still have quite a few that did care about me still. My son and daughter, of course. But my son's here, and he's the one that's seeing all this. So he's the one who activated my tracker. So I'm laying on the floor, and then he texts me or calls me. And he's like, where you at? I said, I'm at home. I'm not feeling good. He goes, Dad, you've been home for 3 days. He goes, I can see it on your phone. I said, yeah. And he asked me, are you tired of shit? And I broke down. I just was like, man, I am so fucking tired of shit. He goes, well, Kelsey, his wife's name's Kelsey. Kelsey and I found, we think would be the perfect place for you to go. Let's go check it out. So he drives from Houston over to Austin, picks me up. We go to the place. It's a lot of music involved, and my whole life has been music. So I say, yeah, let's go. So my first 2 days of detox were so bad that I don't remember them, and I hear stories about them, and I don't like hearing them. But it's what it is. But the hatred, man, I couldn't imagine ever hating anything as much as I hated myself because of everything. Everything I did to my career, to my life, to the people who cared about me, just fucking destroying everything. The hatred was just incredible. I there's no way I was ever going to even begin to even fucking like myself again. Well, I get there, and then on third day, I see the doctor, and I'm semi-coherent. I understand what he's saying, and he's going through my stuff, and he's like, all right. He goes, man, you got a lot of shit wrong with you. And, you know, you got blood pressure, large liver, blah, 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 all the things that are alcohol related by the amount that I was drinking. And he said to me, he goes, well, I'm just going to tell you this. He goes, you barely made it through this detox. He goes, if you decide to grab that drink, he goes, before you get it, make sure you have your shit in order. And I was like, damn, he's cursing, talking to me, holy cow. And I took him serious. So I said, all right, I guess I better fucking start, you know. So I started participating. And then a couple of days later, I went and saw a therapist. And we're talking, and she brought, you know, she's like, why do you drink it? Same answer I always had. I don't know. I do not know. And it was the truth, because I didn't know. So she started delving into my past, my sexual experiences, the marriages, all that. And she's like, man, you are so full of resentment. I've never seen anybody. You know, she didn't say that exactly, but she said that I just had so much resentment. And she goes, you know, and she was this really elegant, older European lady, you know, just class type of person. And it was funny because she says, so what can you do about that past? And I said, nothing. She goes, that's right, you can't do a fucking thing about it. And I'm like, wow, she's cursing at me too. Oh shit. But she was right, and it was crazy. It was a physical change. She goes, you know what? She goes, there's nothing you can do about that. Not one thing you can do to change the past, change what you did, change who you hurt. You can't do anything about it. What you have to do is accept it. That doesn't mean you have to like it. It doesn't mean anything except that you know it happened and you know why it happened. And I swear to God, it was like somebody had been sitting on my chest for fucking 30 years or whatever, and they decided to get off. I was like, what the hell? I felt like warm. I felt this really weird feeling. I guess that was my spiritual awakening happening, I guess, before I even started the steps. And I just felt, whoa. And I was like, man, is it appropriate? Can I hug you? You know, and I wanted to hug her. I gave her a big hug and I cried a little bit. And it's like, man, this feeling's awesome. And so I leave her office, and everywhere you go, music's always playing everywhere, even in the bathroom. So I'm coming out of her office. I'm walking downstairs and the song's on by Nirvana. I knew it. Didn't really care for it. The song was called Dumb. I thought it was dumb because I liked the musical part of it, but the repetitious lyrics is something I've never liked in songs. So I never really listened to it before, but I came down as I'm walking down the stairs. He's at the part of the song. It's like, you know, I think I'm just happy. And then I said, fuck, that's what this feeling is that I'm having going through me right now. I'm fucking happy. And I really dove into that program 110%. I was total introvert, and they got me to, I was a drummer in a band, and, you know, many bands, well, not many, but a lot of bands played enough. I never played a solo. I never wanted to stand out. That was the lead guitar and the lead singer. They got the front. And the funny thing about being a super freaking crazy alcoholic and playing the drums is you can't do it. And I wouldn't. If I had a show to play, the playing the drums was important to me. So I would drink water while I was playing because I couldn't function. Now, you got four limbs going. And I was playing punk rock, and that shit is so fast. So my arms would cramp. You get dehydrated when you drink. So I wouldn't. Those were the times during my really big times of alcoholism that I didn't really drink that much. Till the set was over, all bets off. I'm fucking... Anyway, so they made me play the drums in front of my whole class. And it's like, man, I've never done that before. Then in one other class, I like to write, and they told us we needed to write a song. So we got 15 minutes and wrote a song about our addiction. And they wanted me to sing it. I'm like, I'm not a singer. I can't sing for shit. You know, that's why one of the reasons why I play the drums. Then all of a sudden I'm singing this freaking song that I wrote in front of a bunch of people by myself. And it's like, what the hell? So all of a sudden, man, all these things start happening to me once I bought into the program, regardless of how dumb it seemed, the exercises, whatever they were asking us to do. Man, I was first one done, or I, you know, whatever. I was in 100%. And each day, that feeling that started in that therapist's office just keeps getting better. And it's Monday. This past Monday was the year that my son checked me into that rehab. So I made it a year. And during the course of that year, the whole feeling of being happy has just increased. And, you know, being an alcoholic, the shit's everywhere. It's on TV. People are drinking all the time. It's in the stores. But getting to that realization that, man, I hadn't been happy in forever. God, my that marriage to my mom, my kid's mom, was just horrendous. I was so, man, it was terrible. It was just really torture in a way. So happy like that, or happy being me, just wasn't in existence. I don't know when it happened. And maybe it really happened for the first time that day in her office. But I like it. It's made me, I'm still the same guy. You know, I was brought up to be a good person. I try to be when I can. I help my friends when they need it, if at all possible, if it doesn't cause me any, you know, any financial hardships or whatever. If I can do it, I'm going to do it for my friends and family. And it's just the way that I was brought up. And now it just seems like it's all I want to do anymore. You know, it's like, man, that's not true. It's not all I want to do, but it's just, everything's just so much better. My head's clear. And that's the thing that's what's insane for me, is I'm not used to this remembering shit all the time. It's like, what? Names, that's a different story. So when I got out, and I was still part of outpatient when I started looking for jobs, and I wanted a job in recovery. I what they did for me was a miracle, I think. To get someone who drank so hard as long as I did to not want to, excuse me, was insane to me. So if I could do that, somebody else, it's really what I want. Plus, I totally believe in it. You know, all of us on this call have either been there or work in rehab, and there isn't a person that works there that's doing it for the money. There is no way, because that's just not happening. They're there because they care about what they're doing and they want to be there. And that's something that you can't get anywhere in any other job. You know, I made fucking great money. What did I have? A shit ton of stress, failed relationships out the ass, and an alcoholic of proportionate measures that are astounding. But I just really bought in. I believed in the program, and I work it. I had a great sponsor. He took me through my 12 steps. He called me on bullshit any and every time that he felt it or saw it coming or thought I was leaning that way. So anyway, going back to how I became AR is I wanted to be a tech. I wanted to start out as a tech. And they weren't hiring, but I had cooked before. So there was a cook position open. I applied for it. I get a call from the guy who's running the kitchen, and he's like, hey, man, I'm looking at your resume. First of all, I'm not going to touch anything salary-wise that you're going to be looking for. And I said, that's not the money. I said, what I want to do, and then is work there. And he said, all right, I'll bring you in for an interview. So during the interview, I was completely upfront with him. I said, I'm here to get my foot in the door. And I'm going to work here in the kitchen and learn how to cook this way, because I cooked per order before, not for a massive amount of people. So I had to learn a lot, and he taught me a lot, and he was a good friend to me and a good boss. And, you know, he just, anyway, he gave me the chance, and I'm very grateful to him for it. And I tried to transfer over to RCS at about 3 months in, and then I found out you got to be at the position that you're in for 6 months before you can transfer. Well, at the end of that 6 months is when the AR downfall happened or whatever. So I still wanted to be a part of rehab, so I took a job at Willow Springs doing the same thing, but it's just completely different than AR. It wasn't a good fit, so I kept praying to my higher power, you know, I got to get something different. And bam, I got two people from two different rehabs calling me, we're ready for me to go, and just Nova seemed like the right fit. So on Wednesday, I start work for Nova Recovery as a recovery advocate. And here is a fucking amazing part about, you know, the promises about when you're doing the right next thing, and they, you know, you're following your program on how the promises come and good things start happening. Well, here's a good thing that happened is, one, I'm getting this job. Two, the hours are conducive to where I can go to school now to get my LCDC, which is my primary goal right now. And there's even a bigger bonus. I had a counselor when I was in rehab who I fucking loved this guy, man. He was so awesome. And I was so comfortable with him. Guess who's my instructor for the LCDC class? My old counselor. It's like, man, how awesome is this? You know, here's a guy totally comfortable with, you know, he knows everything there is to know about me, because I, when I told myself I was giving everything, I wasn't going to lie about anything anymore. And if they're asking me stuff, I'm going to tell them every single truth. So this guy knows everything there is to know about me. I'm very comfortable around him, and now I'm going to learn from him and do what he did. So I guess the message is that I have in there that I would like to really pass, and hopefully someone can get something, is that sticking with the program, whatever's working for you, get it that it works. If there is any question on your sponsor not being the sponsor that you need, change. Any sponsor who's worth their weight will completely understand. They're being a sponsor because they want to help. And if they're trying to help you and you're telling them that it's not helping, they're not going to get butthurt that you fire them. You know, find that sponsor who's not going to take your bullshit and that is not going to be your best friend. Find the person who you can talk to who's going to help you, who's going to make you find the answers to the questions that you have. And of course, be there for you. And I don't know if I went over. I apologize if I did, but I think I kind of condensed it right. Damn, how about that for a round time? Anyway, I appreciate you guys being here. One thing that I really, really loved about working at AR was my contact with the clients, you know. You see them come in, especially in the beginning, and then they're fuzzy and they're angry and they're tired. And then as the days go by, you watch that transformation happen. And that absolutely by far was my favorite thing to see working there. And I loved it. And I came to work every day for that, because I had to be around people like me to share stories. And when people would find out I'm in recovery, they'd kind of open up a little bit. People that would help me clean up in the kitchen, we'd sit there and talk. And, you know, it was just, you know, I was telling Chris earlier before we got started, I really was mad losing that job. I really wanted to be there for a long time. But as I say, I guess it wasn't meant to be. What's meant to be is what's happening this week when I start at Nova and then I start my school. Anyway, I guess that's all I have. Chris, I really appreciate you letting me sit here and blab for however long it was. And it's good seeing some faces on here that I recognize. Glad to know that you guys are doing well. Keep it up. Love you all.
Way to go, Fred.
Thank you, Fred.
Thank you, Fred.
Good job, Fred. I'm proud of you.
Yeah, Fred. That was great.